Picture this headline. American, white, male, heterosexual, educated, middle class, Midwestern, omnivorous, sinister, as in left-handed, myopic, as in nearsighted, and wearing glasses, tea-drinking, ear-pierced, wild-haired, atheist guy, formerly Lutheran, successfully oppresses docile and complacent audience into seeing his point of view.
Am I oppressing you?
You don't have to answer that. I don't think that I am oppressing you. And yet, before I even start to talk about privilege, I have a strange desire to apologize for various obnoxious behaviors that I do believe exist, based on such things as race, class, sex, geography, and sexual preference. As Peggy McIntosh writes, I was taught to see racism only in individual acts of meanness, not in invisible systems conferring dominance on my group. So if I say, I'm sorry that I'm white, it's not really a recognition that my skin color has granted me some kind of special privilege that puts me at an advantage, but rather it is an attempt to distance myself from a class which includes American slave owners, the KKK, and Nazis, to say that the class itself does not matter. What matters is the intentional behavior of specific people and groups who happen to fall into a class. It is an attempt to say, as Stephen Colbert does so often, I don't see color. But Colbert cleverly undermines this statement every time he says it. For example, I don't see color. People tell me I'm white, and I believe them because police officers call me sir. In a backhanded way, Colbert is pointing out that being white commands an automatic respect from the police that being any other color does not. Being white carries a privilege, one we tend to be blind to, and which can, in its own right, have negative consequences on others. If Peggy McIntosh were to use the language that Colbert does, she might say, I don't see privilege, but I know I have it, because if a traffic cop pulls me over, or if the IRS audits my tax return, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race. And I might say something like, I don't see privilege. People tell me I haven't because I watch Downton Abbey. We all know what privilege is. We can particularly see it when other people have it and we don't. We know it in its obvious and overt forms. As Mel Brooks says, it's good when you can. We can see it when we watch Downton Abbey, assuming we're privileged to watch Downton Abbey. We can see it when it is codified by various laws, the right to drive, to vote, to drink alcohol, to marry. We can see earned privilege, the right to represent your country in the Olympics on the curling team through your expertise in curling, or to call yourself Super Bowl champion for having won the Super Bowl. In particular, we know it when we intentionally grant privileges ourselves in something as simple as handing out an extra cookie or allowing a child to stay up late. But how do we progress from the very obvious nature of privilege as granting someone or some group a special right, advantage, or benefit, to the concept of privilege as some kind of force field that keeps others down, where we find ourselves members of one class or another, grouped by race, age, sex, nationality, physical ability, religion, sexual orientation, and accused of exerting privilege just by our presence. Are we talking about the same thing? Let's unpack what goes into the idea of privilege and see how it affects us and others. And let's start with the obvious, privileges we can all see. And let's start with history and some of the underlying ideas and structures that privilege is built on. So put on your deconstructionist hard hats and let's take apart the definition of privilege, see what it contains. The definition, as I read earlier, is in a very simplified form, has four parts to it. One, a grantor, someone or some group. Two, gives or grants. Three, something. Four, to someone or some group. Sounds pretty innocuous. When we unbundle the definition, we find it contains the following key parts. One, a power or authority structure, the grantor of a privilege must have some kind of ownership or right to give something. Privilege has an inherent unfairness and inequality. It is specifically something that is not given to everyone. The privilege has a positive value. Receiving a privilege is a good thing. If you receive something that is not a good thing, you would call it a punishment, or a chore, or a duty, or a responsibility. Privilege implies a choice or preference. The grantor chooses the grounds for the giving of the privilege. Thus, for any item that we call a privilege, we should be able to ask the following questions about it. Who gives it, and why can they give it? Who gets it, and why do they get it? And who is left out? Let's travel back in time for a moment and take a look at a very famous letter written to a king. On July 4th, 1776, the Continental Congress signed a group letter to King George III, which we call the Declaration of Independence. It's kind of a poison letter. The letter states, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." We take these words so much for granted that we forget that they're fighting words. They're attack on the then still popular chain of being, a hierarchy of authority that starts with God, works down to kings, lords, peasants, people living in the United States. It is an attack on the privilege of being king and rewriting of where the ultimate authority and power in granting political privilege comes from. If all men are equal, then no man is born king or made one by some farcical aquatic ritual, as Monty Python puts it. Privilege is granted by the consent of the governed. It is a socially created hierarchy. The privilege of being king is not handed down from God, but handed up from the people. Equality is an excellent hammer for breaking up privilege, as it tears down the hierarchy that allows one group the authority to grant privilege. Even more, if it is successfully achieved, equality removes the thing granted from even being considered a privilege. It becomes something that is just given, a right, an unearned entitlement, a self-contained property of everyone. But who has equality? Well, everyone does, right? That "all men" bit is just a fancy kind of rhetoric meaning everybody. Or is it? Is equality itself a privilege that is being granted? If so, who grants it? To whom? And is anyone not included? We know historically that the Declaration of Independence was written by a group of disgruntled, educated, white, male, British, land-owning, Christianish businessmen. Although they ascribe the granting of equality to the Creator, they are the de facto granters of equality to themselves. After all, they are arguing with the king, who says that they are not equals, based on a divine right of some sort. So let's say the divine on each side cancels itself out, and what we have is a self-declared social order of equals arguing with the top level of a hierarchical society. Despite the breadth of unique individuality that made up the Continental Congress, the group contained no Indians, no women, no free black men or slaves, no French or Dutch or other nationality that had also settled the continent, no poor people. The intent of their argument was to establish themselves on an equal footing with the king so as to throw off the bonds of tyranny. The writers of the Declaration of Independence might be social equals with each other and feel equal to a king, but not everyone in their view of the world is socially equal with them. This is a privilege they had, which they probably did not even recognize. If a woman had written the Declaration of Independence, it no doubt would have been a very different thing. In fact, in 1848, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, two American activists in the movement to abolish slavery, called together a conference to address women's rights and issues, in particular because Mott had been refused permission to speak at the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. At this conference, they published and signed, along with other women and men, a document called the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments, which uses the Declaration of Independence as a model. I'm sure you all know about this because you've heard about it in school, right?
No.
The second paragraph begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." It further enumerates what some of the inequalities are between men and women. That is, it identifies what we would call male privilege these days. Here's a few of them. "He has never permitted her to exercise her inalienable right to the elective franchise." I mean, she can't vote. "He has monopolized nearly all the profitable employments, and from those she is permitted to follow, she receives but a scanty remuneration. In fact, any money a woman earned belonged to her husband, if she was married, or to her parents, if she wasn't. He has denied her the facilities for obtaining a thorough education, all colleges being closed against her. He has endeavored in every way that he could to destroy her confidence in her own powers, to lessen her self-respect, and to make her willing to lead a dependent and abject life." Those are harsh, hard on somebody male like myself. But thank goodness this is all history. And thanks to our being born at the right time, all the issues of slavery and racism, patriarchy and male privilege have been addressed. It took the American Civil War, Reconstruction, then the Civil Rights Movement to abolish slavery, root out racism and white privilege, and it took giving women the right to vote, to wear pants, to have jobs with equal pay to that of men, to root out patriarchy and male privilege. These issues are solved, right? No. Sadly, no. As we look at ourselves and our behaviors, we find that privilege runs deep into our social structures. Just as our founding fathers could demand equality for all men, while at the same time remaining oblivious to the inequality of blacks and women, so we too have blind spots to various privileges we have that society gives us. As Betty, a blogger on LiveJournal, writes, "Privilege is not about you. Privilege is not your fault. Privilege is not anything you've done or thought or said, although it may have allowed you to do or think or say things. Privilege is about how society accommodates you. It's about advantages you have that you think are normal. It's about you being normal and others being the deviation from normal." Almost everyone has some form of privilege. And some privileges are easy to demonstrate. Can you go into a random restaurant and order food? That's not something you can do with food allergies, diabetics, celiacs, or other range of conditions. They can't count on the food being safe or being cooked for them. It's not something that people whose religious convictions, such as following kosher, halal, or other faith-based dietary restrictions, can count on in Western society either. In 1988, while she was working on trying to integrate materials from women's studies into the curriculum, Peggy McIntosh noticed that men are unwilling to acknowledge they are overprivileged. They may acknowledge that women are disadvantaged and be willing to work to improve women's status, but they don't admit to their own privileges. In conjunction with this, Peggy noticed that she reacted much the same way about white privilege when she felt accused by non-whites of being privileged. So she wrote, "I began to count the ways in which I enjoy unearned skin privilege and have been conditioned into oblivion about its existence." Here are some of the things she identifies as white privileges. "I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. I can avoid spending time with people whom I was trained to mistrust or have learned to mistrust my kind or me. I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television or open the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. When I'm told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is. I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to the existence of their race. I can be pretty sure of having my voice heard in a group in which I am the only member of my race. I can be pretty sure, I can be casual about whether or not to listen to another person's voice in a group in which he or she is the only member of his or her race. I do not have to educate my children to be aware of systemic racism for their own daily physical protection. I am never asked to speak for all people of my racial group. I can remain oblivious of the language and customs of persons of color who constitute the world's majority without feeling in my culture any penalty for such oblivion. My children are given texts and classes which implicitly support our kind of family unit and do not turn them against my choice of domestic partnership. I feel welcomed and normal in the usual walks of public life, institutional and social. As we move from explicit privileges granted by individuals, governments, or well-defined groups, to those that are granted implicitly based on our culture's social norms and classes, privilege does become like a magnetic field, just something that's there, something pulling a person in because he or she fits the norm, or pushing them away because he or she is not part of the norm. As I thought broadly about privilege, some of the items that came to me were these. Privilege is assuming everyone is male or female, no need for family restrooms in public spaces. Privilege is assuming that a men's restroom does not need a baby changing table in it. Privilege is assuming that I don't have to ask you about your dietary needs or restrictions if I invite you to dinner. Privilege is watching a foreign film with subtitles in my language. So what can we do about privilege? We can continue to raise our awareness, know ourselves, our society. Since privilege is based on choices and preferences, we can influence and change those choices and preferences at a social level. We can be explicit instead of unconscious in our behavior. As we identify privileges, we can try and distinguish between those which are harmful and those which we really want to extend to everyone. For example, we would want everyone to be able to go shopping without being harassed, but we would not want anyone to ignore someone or treat their communications casually or as unimportant based on their race. We can be welcoming and inclusive. We can try to create equality, not assume that it is there. We can work to avoid the trap of believing that being equal requires that we also be the same. We can become empathetic. I need to see myself as others do. I need to see myself as an other so that I can see how I appear. I need to be in what Martin Buber calls an I-thou relationship, an other recognizing an other, not an other as an it or a class or an object. We can celebrate difference, be willing to experience it. We can try and develop a concept of secular grace, the free and unmerited favor of society as manifested in the bestowal of blessings on anyone and everyone.